Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, October 3rd, 2013, and here are some of the headlines we're going to be looking at today. We were thinking maybe we weren't going to be on the air because of the government shutdown, but we found out we don't have a budget through the government. In fact, we don't even have a budget at all, so hey, we figured we'd present the news anyway. But in addition to the government shutdown, we're also going to take a look at what the latest news is regarding Obamacare. And apparently the available revenues for Obamacare are not working out quite as well as originally hoped. Not really news, perhaps, but Bill has some more details about how that is evolving. We're going to take a look at the NSA, the latest revelations from Edward Snowden and The Guardian, and specifically just take a look at the fact that, hey, everything you're doing online is being tracked in a lot more detail than we even knew before. We're going to see if the federal housing agencies need any help. Apparently they do, and Bitcoin apparently took a haymaker to the jaw, but we're going to start off with a shutdown because, well, that's what everybody's talking about, because everybody believes that this is the end of the world, which we announced last week, didn't we, Bill? I mean, we actually got the news in ahead of everybody.
Yeah, we know all. We are prescient. We know exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and why.
Well, we don't always know that. But what have been some of the effects of this shutdown? I mean, there's been a lot made in the media. Everybody's writing a story, if they can possibly write a story, about how this is being affected or that's being affected, or Obama's bending over backwards with the Republicans or thumbing their noses or whatever it might be. But what do we actually know about what's been happening?
Well, I don't like to call it a shutdown. I like to call it austerity. It's particularly
well, okay, if you insist. I'm not sure I'd call it austerity, but okay.
Yeah, prudent austerity. I mean, this is the first time the government has been operating at a balanced budget basis in decades. So if they just keep it up for another year, keep the non-essential services shut down, then we might actually be able to reduce the debt.
Well, they haven't actually balanced the budget, though, have they?
Yeah, well, with the shutdown of non-essential services, the budget is balanced.
I don't get that impression. I could be wrong here.
Yeah, well, it's when they cut out all the non-essential services, the spending drops to the amount of income. And so there's no deficit.
I haven't seen anything that indicates that to be the case. I've only seen that the government is shut down. But, I mean, they're already talking about the debt ceiling being a problem. Unless they're saying that that's going to happen as soon as the government starts up again, but that's not the way I'm reading it. So I don't think the shutdown is actually balancing the budget. Just call me crazy.
I mean, they're not spending the money because they don't have it. They don't have authorization for it.
They're not spending as much, but they're still going to run out.
Well, they just aren't shutting down. They're slowing things down a little bit. Social Security, Medicare, all the entitlements, everything continues the way it was. Veteran affairs are mandatory. Most of the things that are being shut down are really non-essential things, like Department of Homeland Security. But they're cutting the employees that are private contractors, now, you know, not actual employees of the Department of Homeland Security. Department of Health and Human Services furloughed 52% of its employees. Overall, there's supposed to be nobody's sure exactly how many people they furloughed. It's somewhere between 700,000 and 800,000. That's about 18% of the total federal employees, which is like 4.4 million. And so they're cutting out 18% of the expenditures, which is almost exactly equal to the amount of deficit they would otherwise have.
Okay. Well, we'll take that with a grain of salt for now. I won't challenge you any further because I don't have any more details. I just have a little skepticism going on here. Well, that's okay. You know, that's cool. A little story that kind of feeds in what you were talking about. My wife told me this one. She works at a local daycare, and we live about 50 miles from D.C., so we get people in her daycare who work for the government in various roles and so forth. Apparently, one of the parents came in to pick up his kid who I guess he'd been called in early because the kid was running a temperature. So he came in to pick him up, and turns out he works for the government and he works for the NSA. And his comment was that because he is not there, they're not allowed to pay him any money, he's not allowed to leave work. I thought that was good government humor, don't you think?
Run that by me again. Because he's not being paid, he's not allowed to...
Not allowed to leave work, yeah. That's what he said.
Not allowed to leave work or go to work?
Not allowed to leave work, bro.
Well,
the government,
I think there was a directive from the administration saying, do anything that makes the public feel uncomfortable and makes them think that it's really a disaster that this shutdown is happening. And I think the biggest disaster so far was the National Zoo because they turned off the panda cam.
Yeah.
Of course, it costs more to turn it off and shut it down than it would have to just leave it turned on. And that's the case with a lot of their websites. And the websites, they've got all the websites operating normally, except that they bounce up this pop-up window saying, oh, we're shut down. Sorry, you can't look at this page. Of course, all the government computers are being used for Obamacare now, so... maybe they'll have to shut down.
Actually, though, from what I've read, there's only one server serving Obamacare's, the sign-up program, because they figured that and a backup was all they needed. I swear that's exactly what the news report said.
Oh, that's for the national. See, what screwed things up was there was supposed to be a national data center that was going to service 50 state exchanges, and the state exchanges were going to run their own show. And all they were going to do was access this central federal government exchange clearinghouse to get income information and eligibility and all this other stuff for these programs. Well, when like 37 states decided, heck no, we aren't going to set up an exchange, you guys do it. They had to, in spite of the law, which doesn't allow for any such thing, they had to set up federal-run exchanges in these 37 states. Well, they couldn't handle volume, number one. Number two, they hadn't done any trial tests of any of the software, so the software was all screwed up. And according to the various insurance companies participating, in the first 2 days of Obamacare signups, they've signed up six people.
These are the people you want running your health care, right?
Well, I imagine that, over the course of the next month or two, they'll get it fixed. But the thing is that people have to sign up by December 15th in order to comply with the law, because you have to be signed up for it to go into effect 2 weeks later on January 1st, because that's when the actual insurance mandate goes into effect, if it goes into effect.
Well, there doesn't seem to be anything stopping it at this point.
No, Obamacare is supposed to be self-funding. But they're diddling around with the employer mandates, and so they're not getting any money from employers. The employers won't be paying any fines in 2014. They've granted exemptions for literally thousands of different businesses, including all of the grocery stores in Nancy Pelosi's district or something like that are exempt from Obamacare. So it's doubtful whether or not they're going to have the money. And right now they're talking about eliminating one of the heaviest taxes that actually pays for all these people insurance, aside from other finagles, and that's the medical device tax. Any medical device that's being manufactured, they slapped on an additional, 12% tax, which, of course, is going to be paid for by the insurance companies. But if the insurance companies don't get that money, the federal government has already guaranteed the insurance companies they're going to make a profit. So all of these participating medical insurance companies are not going to be collecting the taxes from the medical devices if that's what they end up doing. And there are a lot of Democrats that support eliminating that. Then it's basically going to come out of the general flow of funds. So it's a messy business.
Yeah, it sounds like it's something that math classes all across the country should be paying close attention to, because, it's just a situation that's rife with great math examples. you know, how to do math properly and how to come up with the wrong answer, how to do proofs and how to avoid doing proofs. It's perfect, don't you think?
Yeah, well, the thing is that for literally centuries, the political theory has been that if you just tax most of the people a little bit, then you can give all kinds of free benefits to people that are in the minority. So that's this whole thing of the balance of political power is that if they don't notice that they're losing a little bit more money in their taxes that they're paying, then the government can appear to be giving away free stuff just from their own accounts. So it's a messy psychological thing that people actually believe the government can create something for free. They can give out free health insurance and free this and free that. And, you know, the people that are paying the bills, it's a marginal difference in their tax rates, which has an effect all across the whole economy. It affects every economic decision that everyone makes. So, you know, it's difficult to explain to people what the effects are of this kind of it's a redistribution of income and redistribution of assets.
Actually, it's pretty simple to describe and explain. You just have to use the right example. I mean, I think I'd probably start off by saying this is kind of like what the three-card Monte scammers over on 42nd Street do. And once you understand how three-card Monte is played, you start to begin to understand how that wealth transfer works. It works in such a way that the tourist who's getting scammed transfers his wealth to the three-card Monte expert. And he does it in such a way that he thought for sure he'd know which cup that pee was going to be under, and then it wasn't there.
Yeah, and it covers it's like a lottery. You get a million people chipping in a dollar, and there are five people who get $1 million. For those five people, it's fantastic. Everybody hopes they're going to be one of the five. But for the other million, well, it's buck gone down the tubes. You know, took a chance, big deal.
President Obama, watch the cards. Okay, where's your queen? Do you see your queen? Which one is queen? No. Oh, I'm sorry, we have another loser.
Well, there were a lot of people that misunderstood the shutdown because there were kids that had decided that if the government wasn't going to be operating, then pot would now be legal.
No, you can't have that because then you have to cover it with medical insurance.
Well, what they don't realize is the DEA is going to be on the job with full budget for the entire shutdown period. They're going to be locking up people that are smoking marijuana, and they're going to be, confiscating illegal prescription drugs and all that kind of stuff. So they're not shutting down the DEA.
Of course they are. You've got to lock down the illegal prescription drugs. If you don't do that, then you're going to make it possible for the legal prescription drugs to start charging even more. Oh, no, wait, it doesn't work that way, does it?
The NSA's got it good, though. They have to furlough 70% of their civilian employees. I don't know what percentage of their total employees are civilians, but NSA and the CIA have had to cut back, and so now they're only listening to 90% of your phone calls.
So anyway, you were talking earlier about this being an exercise in austerity, and in fact, there was even an article you found about this being prudent austerity. What exactly is prudent austerity? What exactly does that mean?
Well, austerity is the term that was being used in Europe when the Greek crisis hit.
Which it wasn't.
The austerity was they cut back on the government financing, and they cut back on government expenditures, and they cut back on all of these foolish programs that were bankrupting the government of Greece. So austerity is the term that was used in Europe to refer to government cutbacks because they didn't have any money and nobody would buy their bonds anymore. So we're getting to that point, but in effect, this is austerity is a word that just means we're cutting back on excess, which means they're cutting back on essentials. The word prudential austerity was my own term because
oh, okay.
It isn't a shutdown. They're not shutting anything down. I mean, they're everything is still operating. The government is still running. Nobody will notice a difference unless you're applying for a passport or you want to go to a national park. And it's funny because even some of the national parks, Veterans Memorial Parks and cemeteries, they're intentionally putting up dogs, police dogs, barriers, and armed troops to keep people out of these parks that are open-air parks that require just maybe some cleanup maintenance or whatever every now and then. But they're intentionally closing them down to make as many people pissed off as possible. And there were actually some veterans, and I don't remember if it was Arlington Cemetery or where it was, but a couple of hundred veterans from the Vietnam era stormed the troops and broke through the barriers so they could go and visit their loved ones who were buried in Arlington. So there's a lot of things that are being done that are just totally ridiculous, you know, like shutting down the Panda Cam and things like that.
Well, I'm glad, first of all, that you clarified that you came up with the word prudential, because I thought maybe you were trying to sell us a medical insurance policy or something.
But prudent.
But this whole business about the military, I mean, basically everybody's in agreement about it, aren't they? That should remain funded, that should be untouched by all this. And yet that accounts for a pretty large share of the overall budget, doesn't it?
Don't tell anybody. Nobody wants you to know, and it was never mentioned in the news, but the House of Representatives passed a defense budget. And
don't tell.
They passed it along to the Senate, and the Senate said, we're not going to take a vote on this. Let's just have a show of hands. And so they said, aye, and they passed it. So the Defense Department budget is totally approved, and I think Obama signed it last night. And so all of the military-industrial complex, which is reflected in the Wall Street numbers, are just perfectly fine with a shutdown because all of their income is still guaranteed and budgeted, and it was like 18% increase over last year, even despite the fact they're supposed to be winding down Afghanistan and things like that. So the Wall Street is kind of undecided. You know, there was a $2 billion contract issued on Monday for, I think it was Boeing or one of the Air Force manufacturers. So they're getting their money. You know, the military-industrial complex is swinging along just fine. No problems.
Okay.
And even NASA, you know, there were stories that were running saying that NASA had to shut down the Mars rover because of the government shutdown. They didn't have any, funds. But that turned out to be totally wrong because all of the Mars Curiosity rover is run from JPL. And JPL is not a government institution. It's a contractor for NASA. And they are getting paid and will continue all of their operations as normal. So Curiosity is still roving around Mars.
Well, if certain aspects of the budget are being passed into law and signed by the president, presumably, that means spending continues and so on and so forth. So it raises a rather fundamental question, which is, why do we even bother to have a single budget? I mean, it sounds like Congress is already on the path of setting up a whole bunch of separate budgets and have been doing that for years. Why even bother to talk about a single budget?
Well, because they want to get everything approved at once in a consolidated budget bill. They don't want to approve NASA and DOD and all the departments which is the normal way they had been doing it up until about 3 years ago, and the Senate just decided we're going to do everything by continuing resolution. But that's the way they'd been doing it. They'd pass like a DOD budget, and they'd send it over to the Senate. They'd make changes, and it would go to a conference committee, and the conference committee would come up with a compromise, and then both chambers would approve it and go to the president. It was no big deal. And they did that for each department. There are like 14 or 15 different budgets that were done. Well, now with the threat of not funding Obamacare, coming up as a separate item, the Republicans basically have approved the entire budget, all the budgets for all the departments and all the different categories at exactly what the administration asked for, except they tagged on this little thing saying no funds for Obamacare. And that, of course, the Democrats are not willing to accept.
So here's a really interesting question. What happens if they separate Obamacare from the rest of the budget and say, we approve? No stipulations.
The Senate will say no.
We approve that.
No, the Senate will say no.
Well, I know that the Senate may say no. But
we're not going to talk about these 16 different budgets. And actually, they had approved some, I think, the Commerce Department or something like that months ago. We're not going to allow that to happen. We're not going to allow the Republicans to approve the budgets for the departments they like. We have to have a consolidated bill. It has to include Obamacare. It can't include any other provisions like delaying the individual mandate. We have to have a clean budget, consolidated approval of everything, or we're not going to give you anything. So this is a big rhetorical argument about who's causing the shutdown. I mean, it's the Republicans only want to shut down Obamacare. They don't want to shut down the rest of the government. But Obama in the Senate says, if you don't give us the money for Obamacare, you aren't going to get the money for anything else, unless we do it in a secret vote quietly in the middle of the afternoon.
Now, so far, according to the polls anyway, President Obama is winning that particular war of words, because the public tends to believe by some small majority that the Republicans are responsible rather than the administration. The question,
well,
of course, would be how long was that pattern going to play out?
It depends upon what kind of what polls you look at and what kind of questions they're asking. For example, here's one poll. Trying to find out who it was. So it was a GOP poll in battleground states where it's actually going to be politically significant.
If it's a GOP poll, that means it's completely unbiased.
It was done by On Message, which was supposedly an independent contractor. But anyway, they said 57%.
Do you really believe that?
Well, just hold on a second. They said 57% opposes Obamacare. A majority of the voters, and this is voters in swing districts, and as well as a large majority of independents oppose Obamacare. Now, you go to an Ipsos poll, which is one that's run by Reuters, you find out that 56% are opposed. Now, this is not just voters. This is total, general population.
We're talking about two different issues here. I mean, yes, the majority of Americans oppose Obamacare, but the majority of Americans also believe that the current government shutdown, so-called, is unjustified, and they're against it very strongly. And the polls are also showing that in terms of blaming one side or the other, more are blaming the Republicans than are blaming the Democrats.
Well, again, this is a Gallup poll. According to Gallup poll, and this is general voters, there are general people, it's not just voters, 46% will blame Congress for the shutdown, and 36% will blame Obama. But it's not, the Gallup poll says it's not going to have any effect anyway. Actually, in the 1995 shutdown, which was 17 years ago, something like that, Newt Gingrich, who was the leader of the House at that time, his favorability rating increased by 6 points during the shutdown, which I think went for like 12 days or 20 days, something like that. CNN poll says that 57% of general, population are opposed to Obamacare. Kaiser Family Foundation showed that 44% did not even realize that Obamacare is still the law. Their poll of June says that 33% say they've heard nothing at all about the controversial insurance exchanges, and 34% only know a little about the Obamacare program. So when you get 44% saying they don't even know whether or not Obamacare is still a law, general public surveys are going to be less informative than voter surveys, which is what the original On Message poll was talking to. So anyway, it's one of the libertarian websites, Cato Institute, says that things are going to get worse for, you know, among public polls, worse for Obamacare and worse for the Democrats, because more employers will be dropping health benefits, more employers cutting workers' hours, insurers cutting doctors out of their plans, premiums rising, individuals rebelling against the mandates and penalties, and so on, with all the glitches and meltdowns in the various exchanges and so on. That's going to have a negative impact on the Democrats and on Obama. So it all depends upon what question you ask.
Well, it probably also depends on who you're asking, too, because, yeah. For instance, there's President Obama commenting that federal workers are going to be hurt gravely by this whole thing. And when he was asked what he can offer Republicans to try to resolve the crisis, he says, I shouldn't have to offer anything. They're not doing me a favor by paying for things that they have already approved.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a good argument because obviously Congress has already approved Obamacare, and it's approved all these other programs, and so it's required the executive to comply with the law. And now the actual appropriation of how much money they give to each one of these programs is a totally separate piece of legislation. Otherwise, they say, okay, you know, Obamacare is fine, we'll approve that, but we're not going to approve the funds to actually implement it. So even though the law exists, there's no money allocated to actually execute the law that they passed. Now, that's a silly way to do things. And there's another silly aspect, too, because they've approved programs, and when they get around to approving the appropriations are going to result in a larger debt. So you have to have a debt ceiling increase. But again, that's a totally separate piece of legislation to which they can attach all kinds of riders, and that's coming up at the middle of this month when they hit the limit on government borrowing. So they're, even if the you know, they come to some settlement on the shutdown, there's going to be a debt ceiling contest in 2 weeks. So they're just basically running everything by crisis, and you know, the fact is that the people voted for a crisis because they elected the majority of the House for the Republicans and a majority of the Senate for the Democrats. So if that isn't a desire to have a divided House, a divided government, and therefore conflicts and shutdowns, I don't know what is.
You make it sound so reasonable. I mean, this is a very unreasonable process. You make it sound so reasonable. Very good.
Yeah, well, that's the way it works. Yeah, government is supposed to be bottled up.
Well, on that pleasant note, we're about halfway through. Let's take a break. And after the break, we will continue this very pleasant discussion about how politics is so messed up in this country, and particularly how the shutdown of the government really isn't a shutdown, and so on and so forth. And plus, we'll also take a look at more specifically what's going on with Obamacare and our favorite subject of late, the NSA, because, hey, we shouldn't put them into third place just because the government is in crisis, should we? This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. You're on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. You're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Waltonville. On this Thursday, October 3rd, in the middle of the government shutdown, where everything is nice and peaceful and quiet, except for somebody trying to ram the White House lawn, but that's a sad story that we don't have a lot of details about, so we won't go into details about it. But before the break, we were talking about the polls, and Bill, you actually made a note that was an interesting one. You said the polls might actually get worse over time. Why is that?
Well, just because anytime the government decides it's going to take over an entire industry, there are going to be glitches. There are going to be effects that people weren't anticipating. There are going to be consequences, and there are going to be screw-ups. So psychologically, when people start noticing the screw-ups and start noticing the glitches and start noticing that they're not really getting insurance for $2 a month, then there's just going to be an increase in the opposition to Obamacare. Now, I talked about three or four different polls. They were all in the 55 to 65% range opposing Obamacare, but that's the same as they've been for the past 5 years since the program was first proposed. The public has always been, the strong majority of the public has always been opposed to a national health program. So it's not a surprise that that things are the way they are. 6 months down the road, when people start working on their taxes and start having to pay an additional fee or tax or penalty or whatever they're going to call it, they're going to get upset, even though it's very minor in the first year. Anybody who doesn't get insurance can pay $95 on their taxes, and that gets them by for the entire year. Anytime they want to sign up, they just wait till they get sick, and then they sign up for the Obamacare exchange programs, and they are no longer allowed to take into consideration pre-existing conditions. So as soon as you get sick, you buy into the program, and after you get your treatments, you just stop making payments, and you get fined $100. So there's all kinds of complications in anything like this. I went on to three or four of the different websites. I think it's nationalhealthcare.gov that has the main federal exchange, and they redirect you to the state exchange if there is one. And in this case, it went to state of California. Well, state of California had two or three pages that were actually working. And at the end, you click on the button to enroll, and it takes you to the PDF file describing who you need to contact, what your likely costs are going to be, when you're going to get your tax credit, and all the technical gibberish is in this huge five-page PDF file. And that's the end of the program. It's a similar situation in other states. They've got the upfront stuff to tell you what you're supposed to be paying, but you can't actually enroll, which is why there have only been a handful of people that have actually bought in through the exchanges. That'll probably get fixed, but that's...
Your observation, though, is an interesting one. The idea that as time goes on, more and more people will become more and more disillusioned as they find out what the exceptions are and how what they thought they qualified for, they really is going to cost them more, and yada, yada, yada. It kind of reminds me of what happens when a private enterprise, a private business, tries to promise more than they can deliver. Because the way it usually starts off is, you know, there's this big splash, a big marketing play, media splash and so forth, the big product launch, and all these wonderful things are going to happen. It's going to not cost you anything, and you're going to be able to use it for free forever, and you're going to love it until all of a sudden the stuff they didn't tell you about kicks in. You know, kind of like Facebook, you know? Facebook came in as this free way to connect with your friends and find out, you know, what happened to the people you went to high school with 20 years ago and all that kind of stuff. And then it evolved into this thing where, hey, they're showing you advertising all the time. They're trying to make money off of you. And that's where it started to get a bit of I guess you call it a blowback against Facebook. Well, Facebook got big enough that they could actually resist a lot, and they were able to tease people into accepting the advertising as a necessary cost for providing this wonderful service that they love. So why shouldn't we believe that the same kind of thing won't happen with Obamacare?
Yeah, well, what you're not going to see is a lot of people who are denied medical coverage because of various criteria. It's essentially going to be rationing. In Venezuela is now rationing toilet paper because the government toilet paper manufacturer can't make enough toilet paper to keep everybody's asses clean. And so they're importing toilet paper from other countries. But in the meantime, they have to ration it out. You have to go walk down to the government distribution depot to get your two rolls of toilet paper for the week. And that's all you get. It's free, but, you know, you have to be very careful about how you use it. So the same thing is going to happen with healthcare. I mean, there are going to be people who are denied, you know, medically necessary procedures because it isn't on the agenda and isn't authorized by Obamacare. In Obamacare, the bureaucrats are writing hundreds of thousands of regulations on the insurance companies, and things happen that people don't understand. For example, the insurance companies cannot deny you coverage for pre-existing conditions, but they can require you to disclose it, and they can adjust the fee, the rate for your insurance, based upon that pre-existing condition. So they can't deny you, but they can increase the price, and there are various tiers that they're allowed to do, but they can bump people up into the top highest ratings for the highest premiums if they have a pre-existing condition. So this miracle thing that, you know, they can no longer be denied is true. They just have to pay an arm and a leg in order to get it. That's all.
Well, but you're also promising to subsidize everybody, particularly those who have, say, less than six-figure income, that depending on what your income level is, they're going to subsidize some proportion of your health care in order to make sure that even if you have a pre-existing condition, you can get your health insurance.
Right. But well, the way they're doing that is not is partially by diverting other taxes to that purpose for the subsidies. But what they're actually doing is they're actually cutting the payments to the doctors and the hospitals and the medical service companies, and they're putting taxes on medical devices. So the burden of making this thing work is all on the actual healthcare industry. The insurance company is going to make a profit no matter what happens, but the number of doctors who are willing to take the payments that Obamacare has authorized is going to start falling. Yeah, probably not for another year or two, but it's going to be very difficult. It's already difficult to find a Medicare doctor who's willing to take Medicaid or Medicare patients. They just refuse to treat them. They said, "Sorry, we don't take that." So it's going to be the same thing with Obamacare. They're going to come in with their silver program, and they're going to discover, oh, well, the silver program says you have a $60 copay on this office visit, and you have a 20% copay on all the treatments. And they're going to say, wait a second, I thought this whole thing was supposed to be free. And it's just a customized insurance program dictated by the government, so the insurance companies don't have to compete very much. But the people that are going to take the brunt of it are the actual people who provide medical services.
So let's clarify here. What are you saying? Are you saying that the doctors and the hospitals and so forth aren't going to accept Obamacare insurance?
Right. They don't have to accept any insurance. They aren't required by law to do it. Once they start getting into the rationing state where you have to wait 6 months in order to see a doctor, at that point, they're going to start passing laws to require doctors to take it. But so far, it is not required that any doctor provide you with any kind of care under anybody's insurance. They can say, I only make those office inspections and treatments and so on for cash. They don't have to accept the insurance.
So how long do you think before the doctors and nurses of the United States get drafted into the medical army and are forced to accept Obamacare?
The number of doctors who are general practitioners, who is supposed to be the first person you see in Obamacare, has dropped by like 34% over the course of the past 5 years just because of Medicaid being required. Doctors are required to, not doctors, but hospitals are required to accept Medicaid. So that cuts down their income by 10 or 20% because they're cutting the reimbursement rate. And therefore, all of their other patients have to pay that additional 20% for the people who are on this special program. That means that everybody else's health insurance is going to go up, whether it's on the exchange or whether they're buying it direct from an insurance company or they're getting it from their employer or whatever it is, the rates have to go up in order to pay for all the sick people who are getting it for free.
Okay, that's very nice and good information, but you neatly avoided the question. The question was how long before the doctors and nurses are drafted into the medical army where they're forced to accept Obamacare?
Assuming Obamacare stays in place exactly the way it is and the Republicans aren't able to eliminate any of the provisions, I'm guessing about as long as it took Venezuela to start rationing toilet paper, which was a year and a half. As soon as they nationalized the toilet paper industry, it took a year and a half before people could no longer get as much toilet paper as they wanted.
So it's basically going to be just in time for the beginning of the next presidential election season.
Yes. So
probably not in time for the midterm congressional elections.
Well, no. They aren't going to go to a literal draft. Basically, they're just going to say, well, as long as you're making a profit of 10%, let's say they'll pick some number out of the sky blue. As long as you're making a profit of 6% in your medical business, you cannot close. You cannot shut down. You cannot fire people. You have to take what you get. And that's the way it is. In other words, it's not a literal, we're going to, you know, enroll you as an agent of the government and confiscate your business. They're just going to require them to accept whatever Obamacare offers.
But that's going to be easy to get around, isn't it? I mean, all you have to do is just, you know, take less money in so that your profit is less than 6%.
Well, or you close down your business. And a lot of doctors are closing down their business.
Right.
So, you know, when you go to find
a to me, I don't know about you.
When you go to find a physician to treat your arthritis or whatever it is, and the first thing you're going to notice is that you have a long waiting period. You call for an appointment, and it's going to be 3 months before you can even see him. If you're critically ill and you have to go to the hospital, you're going to be sitting in the waiting room for a couple of days until there's a doctor available to look at you. And then what they might do as kind of an expedient measure is start relaxing some of the medical regulations so that the nurses can give treatments instead of doctors. They're already looking at that as an alternative to keep the services maintained. Nurses will be able to, registered nurses, will be able to write prescriptions for minor ailments. They'll be able to do minor, you know, in-office treatments and all that sort of stuff. So basically, we're going to end up with nurses doing most of the medical care in the United States, particularly preventive care.
You know, but don't ultimately, eat so doesn't much that backfire for the same reason?
How's that?
Ultimately, doesn't that backfire for the same reason that it backfires for doctors?
Yeah, ultimately, yeah, but it just takes time. I mean, you can't. You have to pass the bill before you know what it does. You have to wait until it's actually implemented. And one of the key things they did with this legislation is they implement things in phases. Like the first phase was, okay, insurance companies cannot deny coverage. Although they can charge a higher price, they can't deny coverage for pre-existing conditions. They have to keep children on the parents' medical plan till the age of 26, not 18. They can still charge more in order to include that coverage, but they cannot take away the insurance for children. So those were implemented a year ago. This October 1st, the exchanges are open, you know, as of Monday, Tuesday, yesterday, Thursday, whatever. I can't keep track of these. And so you have to enroll before December 15th. Well, you know, the consequence is that if you can't get on the website to do it, or you can't find somebody who's willing to fill out the paperwork for you because it's, you know, 5 or 6 pages of documentation about your health condition and so on and so forth, then you're not going to get into the exchange and you're going to end up paying the tax penalty. So it takes time. And there are actually some provisions of Obamacare that don't go into effect until 2016. So you won't know all the consequences of what they've actually done for years. One of the reasons why Obama illegally postponed the employer mandate for a year, which he did a few months ago. It isn't allowed by the law, but he did it. And the reason he did it is because they haven't yet been able to write all the regulations that tell the employers what they have to do. They've written like 200,000 rules, but they still haven't covered the provisions related to the employers. So the employers have no idea. And there's a funny little twist to this. There are a lot of unions, major unions, that do medical insurance for their members instead of the employer doing the insurance. Well, they are having a conniption fit because they are now going to be required to provide all this care through Obamacare at the union's expense. So they have been screaming and hollering, and they actually have a court suit going to the Supreme Court saying that they should not be required to comply with Obamacare. They should get an exemption. And the president is probably going to sign very quietly in the middle of the late afternoon Friday a provision exempting all unions from complying with Obamacare because they're not a business. I mean, he's already done this with hundreds of different businesses all across the gamut.
Well, I think we have thoroughly depressed our audience. What do you think? Hey, we've got about 7 minutes left. We haven't touched on the NSA yet, and we really should because despite the fact that Obamacare and the government shutdown are getting all the press, there have been some interesting revelations that have come out of the Snowden-Guardian camp in the past week or two, including the revelation that the New York Times published that said that the NSA is now tracking associations within social media circles. So in other words, if you're a Facebook subscriber or you're on Twitter or you're a Google Plus or whatever, and you have friends in those social media circles, they're tracking those connections. Once again, we have the federal government denying, or more precisely, spokesman for the NSA and the CIA denying that that is actually going on. General Alexander, once again, saying, no, that's not true. This is the same General Alexander who has said this about numerous other things, and each time it's played around, oh, well, yeah, it is true. But this one still is officially not true.
Well, you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking with our friend Jim Faddis. And one of the things I mentioned was the BFG, a big freaking
right.
graph, to be use the French.
And that's what it is. In fact, that's what they call it. They call it the open graph.
Yeah, the it's a social graph. And you know, they've been saying all along, well, you know, we're just collecting your phone number. We don't really know who you are. We don't know, you know, where you live, even though your phone number has an area code in it. We don't know which internet service provider is, you know, servicing your emails. We don't know any of that stuff.
Which is ludicrous. It's just plain
ludicrous.
Anyone who understands how commercial big data works, forget the NSA for a second. Anyone who understands how commercial big data works knows that if you have somebody's email address, for goodness sake, let alone their phone number, you can identify virtually everything about how much money they make, what they bought last year, what their favorite sports team is. I mean, everything about them. And the notion that the CIA and the NSA are completely unable to put that information together, even without all the Snowden revelations, is absolutely ludicrous. Of course they can.
Yeah. Well, it's so obvious. It's surprising to me that they even bother to deny it. I mean, they can cross-reference phone numbers to email addresses to, you know, street addresses to everything. All of your expenditures, this is last week or the week before, saying the NSA is getting all your credit card transactions. So they can tie, you know, your credit card to your email address, and they can basically build an entire profile of your entire life anytime they want to.
So this raises the question, why did General Alexander bother to say that this wasn't true?
Because he's required by law to lie. That's what classified means.
Even though this is like, you know, the classified thing that says that the U.S. didn't get involved in the overthrow of the Shah of Iran.
Right. Yeah, it never happened. You know, I don't know anything about any such thing. It's ridiculous. I'd never heard of it. Because if I say I did, then I'm breaking the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, if he says this to Congress, he's also breaking the law.
Yeah. Well, the congressional thing, and they've got a little blurb here from Justin Amash describing what they've done when they've complied with the oversight Congress is supposed to have over their operations. So he says it's like a game of 20 questions. You ask a question. If you don't ask it exactly the right way, you will not get the right answer.
Right.
If the government, in an extreme hypothetical, let's say, has a base on the moon, if you don't know there's a base on the moon, you're not going to ask about it in the briefing and say, you have a moon base, right? So it's the same thing with the NSA. You know, they send out a dear colleague letter late Friday afternoon saying that they're going to have a disclosure of documents on Saturday morning, but they have to contact the Intelligence Committee and arrange an appointment time between 10 and 11 a.m., they cannot take any notes. And they put it on the Dear Colleague email system, which is basically the spam system. And he says there's just no way. He said he went to one of these things just because he accidentally, one of his staff, noticed this message that came from the Intelligence Committee, and so he decided to go. He was the only person that went. He was the only person that showed up during this hour window or whatever it was to see a particular NSA document about what one program or another. So that's mm-hmm. what the oversight consists of. So they're playing this little game. Same thing with the NSA review board. You know, they basically bring in all the NSA people and say, well, here, you do the review and you report to the president, and the president will decide what he's going to release because it's all classified.
So basically, this is a case of Congress being responsible for the oversight, but they forgot because of an oversight? we got about 1 minute left. We can touch on. I mean, this is normally a program that talks about the expansionary money supply because that's really what drives all this nonsense anyway. Let's take 1 minute and talk about money supply, particularly the supposed heir apparent, the alternative to the money supply, Bitcoin, because the FBI shut down an important piece of Bitcoin. Can you give us that story in about a minute or less, Bill?
Yeah. Silk Road was the primary site for buying merchandise with Bitcoins. And the merchandise, of course, was illegal drugs and all kinds of nasty stuff. And the FBI knew about it, and they said, well, this is not so good. So they went in and arrested the guy that was running the Silk Road Bitcoin exchange market and put him in jail and closed the entire thing down. So you can no longer buy drugs on the Internet with Bitcoins. That's just the latest thing in the whole bureaucratic breakdown and trashing of Bitcoin, which will probably disappear within another year.
Okay, well, that's pretty much a good summary because you actually did it with time to spare, so congratulations on that one. I'll throw in one last note in the last 30 seconds we have or so. We were talking a minute ago about the NSA. The Wall Street Journal published an article, I believe it was last week, in which they included deep buried in the article a very interesting statistic. They said that according to an organization called the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, they estimate that the fallout from revelations about NSA activities could cost Silicon Valley up to $35 billion in annual revenue, much of it lost in overseas business. And a survey conducted this summer by the Cloud Security Alliance, which is an industry group, found that 56% of non-U.S. members said security concerns made it less likely that they would use U.S.-based cloud services, and 10% said they had canceled a contract. So one of the most interesting points to me about the NSA is they keep saying, well, this is all national security. What about national economy? It seems like they have kind of forgotten that part of the puzzle.
Yeah, well, you know, why should they care? They've got a government salary. They don't. The economy doesn't matter to them. No, when people discover the truth and they discover what's going on, there are consequences. So you have to keep people in the dark. You have to lie to them. You have to.
Well, not us. We're going to keep people in the light, but we're going to have to do it again next week.
Hey,
and Bill, you
bring on
a pleasure.
The light. Yes.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. Talking about a revolution.